right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And you're in for a treat today. We have a packed show. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing from Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party about a call for action in April. It's no business as usual.
That's right. There's a call out for April 14th to be made a day of no business as usual. All over the country, people stepping up and stepping out to make April 14th a day of no business as usual to stop police murder.
Before that, we'll be talking with Larry Seams. Larry is the editor of a brand new book called Guantanamo Diary by Mohamedou Ould Slahi. It's the first book to be published by an inmate who is still imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay, so stay tuned for that. Opening the show up, I'm very glad to be welcoming to the show Andy Worthington. And I'm not going to do much of an introduction because I had an opportunity to talk to him just before the show, and I'm just going to jump right into it. So check this out. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my first guest, Andy Worthington. Andy's been a frequent guest on the show over the years, and he is also a freelance investigative journalist, and he's been researching and writing about Guantanamo since 2006. He's the co-founder of the Close Guantanamo campaign, and he's the author of the book, The Guantanamo Files. He's also the director of We Stand With Shocker, an international campaign for the release of Shocker Ammer, the last British resident held at Guantanamo. Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Michael. Good to be talking to you.
You too, man. It's been a while, but I'm glad we're catching up, although it would be nice if it was under celebratory circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously.
Let's see. Why don't we start with what the situation is overall with Guantanamo Prison right now?
Okay, well, you know, there are 122 men still held there. You know, that's the lowest figure it's been since very early in the prison's existence, because the total number of people held is 779. You know, there's been progress over the last few months. The Obama administration released several dozen prisoners, and that was the most significant number of prisoners that have been released for a very, very long time. It came about because, I think it's fair to say, there was a certain enthusiasm within the administration to move forward on releasing the prisoners who have already been approved for release by a number of high-level government review processes, and to, you know, to move towards trying to get Guantanamo closed in some way, as the president, of course, promised when he first came into office, you know, what's now 6 years ago. The situation at Guantanamo is only ever as good as the last news. And, you know, we haven't had any more releases recently. We've got hostile lawmakers, Republican lawmakers in Congress trying to tie the president's hands again. And, you know, the defense secretary situation, the defense secretary has to sign off on, has to certify that it's safe to release prisoners that they want to release. And of course, there's a kind of period of flux going on there, Michael. So, you know, we've got the outgoing Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, and no one quite being sure yet what's going to happen with the new guy. So that's kind of where we're at.
You know, the last time we spoke, Andy, we were in the middle of a hunger strike at Guantanamo. What are the conditions that the prisoners are facing now?
Well, you know, I think they're aging. I think they're incredibly frustrated, and I would say that leads to a feeling of depression in many cases. We don't know how many people are still on a hunger strike, Michael. I mean, that hunger strike 2 years ago was one that, you know, woke the world's media up to what was happening, put pressure on the Obama administration, got the ball rolling again. You know, and eventually the military stopped reporting on it as a good way of shutting the media up. So they, you know, in December 2013, they stopped saying how many people were on a hunger strike. My feeling is that it's probably a few dozen of the men still held. Certainly, you know, somewhere around half a dozen of the men have been in a hunger strike for many, many, many years. A few men there certainly who've been persistently hunger striking since 2007, which, you know, I just find unimaginable. How you could do that, how you could stay alive by being, you know, force-fed horribly every day of your life for 8 years. But that's the situation.
You know, Andy, one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the show so badly right now is we're going to be talking with Larry Seams, who's the editor of the book Guantanamo Diary, which is by Mohamedou Ould Slahi. And it's the only book to come out basically with the first person narrative from inside the prison, from a prisoner inside Guantanamo. And it's a stunning book, a very compelling and stunning book. And I kept thinking about that in relation to, you know, here's a man who was sent there who's undergone all kinds of horrors during his time there. And I kept thinking about that. And then you being involved with the Shocker Ammer campaign, because his name, Shocker's name, kept coming up in my mind as I read Guantanamo Diary. Can we talk about Shocker's situation a little?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we can. You know, Shaka Armour is a very principled, eloquent man who, you know, from the moment that he was first captured in Afghanistan at the end of 2001, where he says he had traveled to undertake humanitarian aid work, no one's ever proved that that wasn't the case. From the moment he ended up in U.S. custody, I mean, I think he was first handed around amongst Afghans who were collecting money for bounty payments. But as soon as he got into U.S. custody, and of course, you know, the conditions were wretched in those early days in Afghanistan, then he started resisting. He started saying, guys, you know, you're the United States. We look up to you for upholding standards of treatment, and you seem to have forgotten what you're supposed to be doing. He encouraged people to go on hunger strikes from very early on, I believe. He was somebody whose charisma and intelligence and passion meant that he drew people to him. Plus, of course, the fact any prisoner who spoke English very confidently was somebody who was able to liaise with the authorities. So all the English-speaking prisoners were in that kind of position. But, you know, as a result of his leadership, and I mean that in terms of human rights, I don't mean that in terms of, you know, terrorism, because there's no proof that he was ever involved in anything. Because of his leadership amongst the prisoners, then he's been, you know, isolated for many years of his detention. I think, like a number of prisoners who are capable of, you know, having a leadership role on the other prisoners, you know, they also get punished. Shaka Armour has specifically been subject to a lot of physical violence because he constantly is trying to resist the regime that's imposed upon him because he doesn't believe in it. And the poor man was told under the Bush administration in 2007 that a military review board had approved him for release. The Obama administration then set up a task force to review the prisoners' cases. In 2009, they reviewed all the prisoners' cases. He was again approved for release, and yet he's still held. And you know, it's a truly dreadful situation, Michael. In the same way that you read the words of Slahi, and here is an intelligent, compassionate, somehow funny even person writing about the terrible things that have happened to him. You know, and then you're stuck with this understanding that, you know, actually Slahi isn't in a position where he's even been approved for release, although a judge orders his release many years ago. You're hearing eloquently from Guantanamo the voice of a man who clearly shouldn't be held, and yet there's nothing that any of us can do about it to actually, you know, extricate him from that terrible place and restore him to his liberty, as is so obvious what should happen. And, you know, I'm delighted to see so many people reading Slahi's book. And those people who've been watching will have seen over the years, particularly because of various lawyers of his, but I would say particularly Clive Stafford Smith of Reprieve, constantly has, you know, got Shaka's words through the classification process that the Pentagon imposes. What's been unclassified has been, you know, made available to the public, often through articles in newspapers. And here, Shaka Armour, like Slahi, this, you know, this wonderful, eloquent person who clearly just shouldn't be there. But how do we get him out?
You know, Andy, one of the things, well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's a freelance investigative journalist. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, and he's currently the director of We Stand With Shaka, an international campaign for the release of Shaka Armour, the last British resident held at Guantanamo. Now, Andy, one of the things I'd ask you is, having gone through Slahi's book, it's a collection of some of the most moving and most heartbreaking stories you can imagine, and including the fact that here's a man who, you know, when I listen to what you say, it's similar to what Shaka's case is. Shaka has never been charged with anything. Slahi has been ordered released by a judge, and yet they still both sit in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
What's the justification for that?
Well, you know, there isn't, is there? I mean, the justification in Shaka Armour's case is that although he's been approved for release twice at, you know, the high government level, there must be other forces resisting his release, either because certain people, probably in the intelligence services, would like him to go to Saudi Arabia, where he wouldn't be at liberty to speak. That seems the most likely. It's hard to know how transparent the British government are being. They claim that they're doing their best for him, but if they really put their foot down, I'm sure they could get him returned. So I think it's that he's embarrassing, and therefore they just, you know, they can't face the notion of having this man embarrass them by speaking when he's free, even though he's embarrassing them while he's behind bars. But, you know, that's an example to me of the lawlessness of Guantanamo, that because there's no process in place to release people, I mean, it's purely political. You know, there isn't an end of a war, there isn't an end of a sentence. It's political. Without the political will, all of those men will rot in Guantanamo forever. So that's an awful situation to be in. With Salahi, Judge Robertson, who back in 2010 said, look, you don't have anything on this guy. He's been in places in proximity to people that you think are bad guys, but there's no proof whatsoever that he's ever done anything. Let him go. The Obama administration's Department of Justice, so, you know, under President Obama, under Eric Holder, decided to appeal that ruling. That ruling went to the D.C. Circuit Court, which was particularly hostile towards the Guantanamo prisoners for nakedly political, ideological reasons. Vacated that ruling and sent it back to the lower court. Now, it's never been considered again, as far as I understand. So Salahi was kind of abandoned. You know, but when that habeas petition came through, there was a lot of uproar from the right-wing press and from Republicans, you know, saying, well, this is a bad guy. How dare the judge order his release? Because they are wedded to the mythology that they've created about the Guantanamo prisoners and not to the actual facts. And the actual facts are that, as Judge Robertson, you know, pointed out painstakingly, there is no evidence that this is a bad guy. You may want there to be, but there isn't any. And I think that's really at the heart of a lot of the problems of Guantanamo, is that, you know, persistently, right-wingers, either lawmakers or, you know, those baleful people in the media, are constantly saying, we want Guantanamo to be this place full of the most hardened terrorists, and that only by keeping them there in this lawless state can we look after you and look after ourselves. And it's just not true.
You know, Andy, one of the stories that Mohamedou talks about being tortured in Guantanamo. Has Shaker also undergone torture there?
Well, he says that he has, yeah. I mean, there's an incidence of him saying that he was tortured very badly on the night that three men died in Guantanamo in June 2006, you know, for which the official story is that they committed suicide. There are many reasons for doubting that. And, you know, I would recommend your listeners, if they're interested, to pick up Murder in Camp Delta by former Staff Sergeant Joe Hickman, who was in charge of the guard towers on that evening, who was the main person responsible for saying, you know, I was there that night. The explanation for what happened is not possible. So, you know, I would recommend people look into that. And Shaka said that he was very badly abused. That's the same night that these three men died. That would, you know, put him in a position where, you know, he certainly knows, you know, some terrible stories that they don't really want publicized. But that story's been publicized, and not via Shaka, you know, via Joseph Hickman, via Scott Horton, the law professor and journalist who wrote about it. Similarly, you know, in Salahi's case, even without his own words about it, we already had reports over the years from people like the man who was supposed to be his prosecutor when he was supposed to be put forward for a military commission trial, which collapsed, who I believe was Stuart Couch, who refused to do so because he was so appalled by the torture that Salahi had been subjected to.
You know, Andy, we have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to make sure we get into this, because when I talk about who you are actually one of the world's foremost experts. Unfortunately, if you have to be an expert in something that's good for the people but not so good, this exists, on the Guantanamo prison and what happens there. You authored the book Guantanamo Files, and you've continued to do this fight. Now you're very much centered on, it seems a lot like, getting Shaker Amer out of Guantanamo. What's the organization, it's called We Stand With Shaker? Tell people what that is and how they can get in touch and find out more about it.
Well, I mean, I encourage people to go and have a look at westandwithshaker.org. Shaker is spelled like Shaker. And what people will find there is the whole story of what the campaign is. And, you know, we have photos of MPs and of celebrities. There are actors and comedians and musicians standing with a giant inflatable figure of Shaka Armour that we made, which, you know, somehow managed to grab people's attention, actually. And, you know, I've been focusing on his case because he's a British resident and because there's no reason for him not to come home to the UK, and because as a British citizen, it's something that, you know, the one person that we can actually try and help, you know. I'm obviously remain concerned about all the other people, but it's objectionable to me as a British person that we can't get him back here. And it's the campaign has, for various reasons, partly itself and its own momentum and our ability, I think, to touch a nerve. But also, I think because of the timing, you know, it's 13 years now. People are getting fed up of hearing that people are still held without charge or trial after all this time. I think perhaps because of the ripples from the torture report, which appalled so many, you know, decent people, it's got to a very high level of people reasonably close to the government, I would say, conservative figures in the UK. The conservative newspaper, the Daily Mail, has been backing the campaign. But yet, you know, he's still there. We still haven't managed to be able to unlock this block, whatever it is, which, you know, as I was saying, I suspect is something to do with the intelligence services on both sides of the Atlantic. But, you know, it's so hard to get anyone out of Guantanamo, Michael. That's fundamentally the problem. You know, we have, you know, 54 guys approved for release in Guantanamo of the 122 men still held. Most of those men are Yemenis. No one wants to send them back to Yemen. Everyone agrees on that. So, you know, little by little, other countries are being found that are prepared to give new homes to these guys. You know, I commend the Obama administration for the work they did over the last few months, but, you know, there's still a lot of guys to get out. And the longer you hold people that you say you don't want to hold, the less you can pretend that you really stand up for justice.
All right, Andy, on that note, we're going to have to run for it, but I want to thank you very much for being there, okay? For being there and for being on the show today.
It's great to talk to you, Michael. Thank you.
You too, Andy. Look forward to talking to you again soon. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Guantanamo from Chris Washburn and the Scioto's Band. Just a beautiful, beautiful piece and stands in stark contrast to the reality of Guantanamo. My next guest is a man who is responsible for a book. Although he's not the author of the book, he's responsible for getting out into the world in a big way. His name is Larry Seams, and he's the former director of Freedom to Write, an international program at Pan American Center, and the author of The Torture Report, What the Documents Say About America's Post-9/11 Torture Program. Larry Seams, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. It's fairly unique because we're doing a story around a book, and we can't talk to the author, but we can talk to you, who played a very, very important part in getting the book out into the world, even though you're not the author. And in some ways, you actually contributed to writing it. Can you tell people what the book is and how you came to be involved in this?
Sure. The book is Guantanamo Diary by Mohamedou Ould Slahi, who's a prisoner in Guantanamo to this day. He wrote the book in 2002. He hand wrote it in English, which was his fourth language, over a period of months in an isolation hut that he had been dragged into a couple of years before as part of one of the most brutal tortures that happened inside of Guantanamo. And as I say, he wrote the book in 2005, beginning in March of 2005 when he found out he was finally going to meet his attorneys. And he gave several pages to Nancy Hollander, his lead attorney, and a partner of hers at the time, Sylvia Royce, when they visited him in March of 2003. And with their encouragement, he wrote it, you know, continued to write and completed the manuscript by September. Like everything that a Guantanamo prisoner writes, the manuscript was immediately considered classified just from the moment it was created. And it was taken away and locked in a secure facility outside of Washington, D.C., accessible only to his attorneys with their, you know, full top secret security clearances. And of course, they couldn't talk about it or anything. And it remained there for about 7 years while his lawyers, led by Nancy, who are really the real heroes of the story, carried out litigation and negotiations to force the government to declassify the manuscript and clear it for public release. That happened in the summer of 2012. They were able finally to give me the redacted version of his handwritten manuscript that you know, formed the basis of this amazing book.
This was quite a task for you, too. It's both a challenge and an opportunity to do something that was really unprecedented, both in publishing and in terms of the sort of medieval torture chambers that the U.S. has set up in Guantanamo, to really bring out, like, the first voice that has been able to bust out there on their own and while they're still in Guantanamo.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's a voice from, you know, the kind of the deepest void, and it's such an amazing voice. And, you know, it was amazing because in the summer of 2012, when I was handed this thing, I had a good idea of how remarkable it would be because, as you said, for the previous 4 years, I've been working on this project called the Torture Report. My job was to sort of sift through about 140,000 pages of documents that the ACLU had managed to get declassified and released through FOIA litigation about prisoner abuse in Guantanamo, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the CIA black sites, to go through these things and try to look for characters and narratives and try to put them together into sort of emblematic stories of the torture program. And one of the characters that emerged most strongly was Mohammed Islahi, because his torture in Guantanamo was so deliberate, approved at the very highest levels. His torture plan, they called his special project interrogation plan, was signed off on by Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. So there's this huge paper trail about the torture that Mohammadi describes in the book. So I knew that it was likely to be a pretty harrowing story. I knew it was an epic story because he had been, you know, sort of dragged through a global gulag of detention sites even before he got to Guantanamo. He had turned himself in voluntarily for questioning in his home city of Nouakchott, Mauritania, and was essentially disappeared. The U.S. sent him on a rendition plane to Jordan, and he was interrogated in a Jordanian intelligence prison for 8 months. Then another CIA rendition plane took him to Bagram and then to Guantanamo. So, like I say, I knew it was an epic story. And I also knew, just because in these documents there were a couple of transcripts of his hearings inside of Guantanamo that had little bits of his voice, I also knew he was quite a remarkable storyteller with a great eye for detail, a really good sense of humor. So when I got the manuscript in 2012, like I said, I had a sense that it would be something quite amazing. But even so, I had, you know, I couldn't imagine the sort of the depth of just skill and empathy and humanity with which he would be able to convey this incredible experience.
Yeah, I really want to emphasize that as well. I mean, I was very, very moved by what emerged as the character of Mohammadu Ould Slahi. Now, let's talk about Mohammadu a little bit more here, because I want people to understand that, you know, you're reading a book and it's just a guy taking a trip, and then all of a sudden he goes from just a guy on a plane to a man who spent, like, how many years? Since 2002 he was brought to Guantanamo, but at the end of 2001 when he was actually picked up in the beginning, and he's been there ever since. So we're looking at 13, 14 years entrapped in this system, and yet he managed to write a book that was full of both a very good sense of the ironic and a good sense of the absurd, and you know, many people who've looked at the book have referred to it as Kafkaesque and Dostoevsky and all these people. He's dealing with something that was just so intensely absurd but intensely repressive and oppressive, and every day his life is on the line, and yet what comes through is a person who's really trying to maintain his humanity and his sense of humor and his view of some kind of future.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this is what moves in any form. You know, his first-person testimony would have been extraordinary because his story is so extreme and extraordinary. But his book moves beyond sort of testimony, personal testimony, into a real realm of literature. You know, and I think it belongs on a shelf of some of the great writing about prison and, you know, and prison communities that has ever been created. He, like you say, he maintains his humanity in the most dehumanized situation. And he does it because he's intensely interested in those around him. He's curious and he's empathetic. These are his two kind of, you know, most obvious and compelling characteristics. He's constantly drawn outside of himself by his environment, and that he's driven by his curiosity to learn English, to master English. There's a scene early on when, as you say, he's, you know, flown to Guantanamo on a flight with 34 other detainees, and he arrives there in August of 2002. They've had a 30-hour flight on a freezing cold airplane, shackled in uncomfortable positions. You know, they're hooded, and earmuffs and all of these things, and they throw them into a truck, and the guards are shouting at all these orders at him in English, which at that point he doesn't know very well. You know, sit down, shut up, cross your legs. And one guard says, do not talk. And another guard says, no talking. And he thinks to himself, you know, in the middle of the extreme discomfort and pain that he's feeling, and certainly fear, he thinks to himself, wow, they give the same order two different ways. No talking, do not talk. That's interesting. You know, so he's just the sort of man who's, you know, he's always looking at this larger environment. He's fascinated by language. He's fascinated by the characters of his captors. And the result is, you know, this is not only the first, I think, you know, really in-depth look at what it is like to experience the kind of treatment that Mohamedou experienced, but it's also an extremely moving and, you know, upsetting, but also revealing look at what it's like to be a person who's put in a position of having to mete out this kind of treatment. The book is a tremendous reclamation of humanity, not only for somebody who's tortured, but for, you know, those who were asked to torture him as well. And you get these vivid portraits of guards and interrogators who, you know, we recognize these are our brothers and sisters, our mothers and fathers, our sons and daughters. And these are the men and women who we've asked to carry out these, you know, really quite appalling and, you know, immoral and at times quite ridiculous programs. And you get a sense of the toll that it's taken on them as well.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Seams, and he's the former director of the Freedom to Write and International Programs at Pan American Center and the author of The Torture Report, What the Documents Say About America's Post-9/11 Torture Program. And Larry is also the editor of a new book called Guantanamo Diary, which is written by Mohamedou Ould Slahi, who remains a prisoner today inside Guantanamo. Now, Larry, one of the things you were just saying, you know, it's interesting because part of what I was really moved by with Mohamedou is that, well, one, actually, people should understand that when he set out to write this book, he actually, when he was picked up, he didn't speak much English at all. And he wrote the entire book in English, which is quite a feat when you're looking at over just a few years. And he learns English inside this hellhole.
It's an incredible achievement. He's obviously a tremendously gifted person. He was already fluent. He was bilingual from childhood in French and Arabic, of course, because he grew up in Mauritania. He's the ninth of 12 children of a rather poor family. His father was a camel trader. The family moved to Nouakchott, the capital of Mauritania, when he was a teenager, right about the time his father died. And Mohamedou was clearly a favored son and a son on whom the family pinned its hopes, its economic hopes and dreams. And he won a scholarship when he was in high school to study electrical engineering in Germany. He had memorized the Quran as a child, you know, so he obviously had great intellectual gifts. And he went to Germany and earned an engineering degree and, you know, lived and worked as an electrical engineer in Germany for most of the 90s. So he was then, of course, fluent in German. And then he lived briefly in Canada, and I think he had, you know, some rudimentary English from a couple of months in Canada. And, you know, and many Germans have quite good English. So he had a foundation of English, but, you know, it really was his contact with his guards and his interrogators that led to this incredible work that's written in English. And, you know, there's something really telling about it. It's not just a natural gift and fascination for language, but it's also this real desire to communicate with and understand every single person that he came in contact with, and obviously learning the language of his guards and interrogators was an essential part of that process. He has just a fascinating and extremely admirable ethic as a writer and as a person. He said, you know, he treats everyone as an individual. He says, you know, we're all a combination of good and bad. The question is, you know, what percentage of each? And so he's, you know, he's just constantly compelled to, you know, think about and examine the inner lives of the men and women who are shaping his destiny every single day.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a few of the particulars about his case. One of the things that really got me is that, you know, you look at this and there had to be a tremendous risk in him doing this. What was the risk to Mohamedou in writing this book in the first place? You know, he has to keep it in his cell wherever he is. He has to keep the thing there. It stays together. He has to And when people read the book, you understand when people come in, when these guards come in, they just rip apart everything. They can take anything and everything from you all at once. You know, there's all kinds, and the different personalities of the guards are matched up to drive you kind of insane. What's the risk in a person sitting in the middle of that writing a book like this? And I have to tell people, it's an extremely, I'm going back to it a second time, and I'm really, really moved by what I read there in terms of the treatment and also the inhumanity and the humanity that's concentrated in the entire book. So what's the risk to Muhammadu in writing this book and getting it out like he is now?
Well, it's really interesting. I think that's a really interesting question. I hadn't really even thought about it in those terms. He wrote the book in 2005 at a time when the worst treatment had passed. His special interrogation, special project interrogation, ended in 2004. And at the time he was writing the book, and he writes really up to that present moment, it's very clear that there's, a recognition on the part of the military authorities in Guantanamo that they have taken him to the brink psychologically, physically, and so there's a real clear effort to rehabilitate him. He talks about a new team of guards whose job that are assigned to him. Their job is to be nice to him and really specifically to help in his rehabilitation. And one of those guards, very poignantly drags his mattress in front of Muhammadu's cell, and they spend nights just talking to each other all night. So he writes it during that period when, I think there was a sense that, the worst was behind him. And, so he was, I think, maybe breathing a little easier, and he had a chance to kind of reflect a little bit on his experience. And I'm sure that the writing process was an essential part of that recovery to some extent. So, I never thought of it in terms of risk. I thought of it much more in terms of faith. What an incredible act of faith this is on his part, that if he just faithfully and honestly tells his story and does it in a way that preserves and recovers his dignity and the dignity of some of the guards and interrogators. Because remember, torture dehumanizes not just the tortured, but also the torturer. That if he does these things, and just does it accurately, that manuscript will eventually find its way to us, and he addresses us, the American people, directly. What do you think, dear reader? He says it several times in the book. If that manuscript just makes it to us, that there will be some movement, that this kind of crazy deadlock that, exists in Guantanamo, that's a combination of legal limbo and, bad politics and just kind of delaying accountability for terrible mistakes will be broken. And I think, I am a lifelong advocate for freedom of expression and the power of writing. And, for me, I was constantly inspired by that gesture of faith he said, I'm going to tell what my experience, I'm not going to exaggerate, I'm not going to understate it, I'm just going to tell you what I experienced. And just in doing that, and, the faith that it would make it out of this, kind of lockbox that is Guantanamo and eventually, be published and be received the way it's been received, is so inspiring.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Seams, and he's the former director of the Freedom to Write and International Programs at Pan American Center and the author of The Torture Report, What the Documents Say About America's Post-9/11 Torture Program. And Larry is also the editor of a new book called Guantanamo Diary, which is written by Muhammadu Ould Slahi, who remains a prisoner today inside Guantanamo. Well, one thing I wanted to talk about, too, is that part of the thing that got me is here's a man who went through being picked up and actually driving down to the police station himself to turn himself in, go for questioning or whatever. And he ends up going through this incredibly horrible journey that involves detention, rendition, and finally ending up in prison in Guantanamo. And he went through a number of places. I mean, he was in Mauritania, he was in Jordan, and he ends up from Jordan to Bagram, and then from Bagram to Guantanamo. Jordan was a place that really, everybody always talks about Jordan as like, that's a place, if you go there, you're sort of, the big secret is, and it's not so secret, that torture is going to be heinous.
Right. I mean, one of the really fascinating elements of the book is that it's, it isn't just Guantanamo, but it's kind of this, this odyssey through this secret network of intelligence prisons around the world. And so there's a kind of a comparative study of intelligence prisons and interrogation that goes on just implicitly within the book. He was, as you say, he reported for questioning, voluntarily drove himself to the police station in November of 2001, was told that he would be home in a day or so. Instead, the Mauritanians held him just long enough for the U.S. to arrange for a Jordanian rendition flight to take him to this prison in Amman, where he was held for about 7.5 months. And we know from a Human Rights Watch report, we know which prison that is, and we know that he was one of about 15 people who were renditioned to Jordan at this time period. And that time period is before the CIA black sites had opened. So I think this was, this was a period where the CIA was using proxy torturers and interrogators before it opened up its sort of its own secret operations. What's interesting is that, he's quite, open in talking about the kinds of pressure that he was under in Jordan, but, it was nowhere near the level and magnitude of abuse that he would suffer in Guantanamo. The Jordanians mostly, they were certainly torturing in the prison, and their pressure on him was essentially to make him listen to or hear or be in the proximity of that torture as a kind of pressure tactic. And then they would move him. He was a secret prisoner there, which meant that every time the International Committee of the Red Cross came to visit the intelligence prison, they moved him to the basement so that nobody would know he was there. I mean, this is enforced disappearance. He had been disappeared from the face of the earth. His family still thought that for a whole year, thought he was still in the local prison in Mauritania, and they were delivering food and clothes to that prison. So, and that's in itself a gross human rights abuse that's tantamount to torture because of the anxiety it causes the family and the prisoner, knowing how anxious the family must be, not knowing where he is. So there was clearly a level of abuse that rose to torture in Jordan, but, it was really this special project interrogation that happened in Guantanamo that, is the most horrific onslaught that he faced anywhere.
One of the high points of that is this mock execution. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and again, as I said before, these were things that were planned, written out in special interrogation plans that went through several drafts and were signed off on by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. The original plan called for essentially what happened to him. They moved him into ever more extreme isolation, subjected him to ever more extreme sleep deprivation, until ultimately, he was being interrogated by three shifts of interrogators for 20 out of 24 hours every day. He was subjected to freezing cold rooms, sometimes nude, sometimes doused with water, shackled in stress positions, forced to listen to, heavy metal music, strobe lights, many, many death threats against him, and ultimately a ruse in which they pretended that they had captured his mother and were going to bring her to Guantanamo. And then, as you say, this, mock kidnapping and rendition. In the original draft, according to the Department of Justice's 2008 report about FBI complaints about interrogations in Guantanamo, the original draft of his special projects interrogation plan involved dragging him out of his cell, shackling him, binding him, and putting him in a helicopter and flying him out over the Caribbean, probably to threaten to kill him, and then pretend that they were taking him to a third country. According to that report, the general, the commandant of Guantanamo decided not to do that because too many people would know about it. And again, these were things were really kept in close secrecy. There were only, small units of the larger operation even knew that these things were happening. So instead, what they did was they dragged him out of his cell with a kind of commando team, shackled him with hooded, blindfolded, and threw him in a motorboat and sent him out into the Caribbean with two interrogators, a Jordanian and Egyptian interrogator, pretending that they were going to take him to one or the other of those countries, which he thought was quite funny with his typical sense of irony and humor. He notes that, he'd already been to Jordan. He'd already seen what they gave, so it wasn't such a terrifying thing. But so they're threatening pretending that they're taking him to one of these countries, and they're beating him, and they're alternately beating him and filling his jumpsuit with ice in order to, alleviate the swelling and bruisings from the beating, but also to, induce essentially close to hypothermia or hypothermia. And so they do this for several hours. The boat lands again, and they pretend again that they're dragging him into some now other country's prison. And all along, he knows where he is because they've been doing these things, and the prisoners tell each other these stories. So he said, I knew all along that I was just being taken to a new place, and that new place is a isolation hut that's been prepared specifically for him. Everything blacked out so no light can enter, and he remains there for several months. Well, he remains there, in fact, for several years, but they eventually open up the windows and it becomes a living space. But for several months, the interrogation, the sleep deprivation continues until he's taken to, the absolute, extremes. And as he describes very vividly in the book, he begins hearing voices, the voices of his family, the sort of heavenly choruses of Puranic readings. And we know that this is true. And, it's important to emphasize that everything that he tells about in his experience, the torture that he describes in Guantanamo, is completely corroborated by the government's own reports and documents that have been released. And in those documents, quite chillingly, is an email from one of his interrogators to an army psychologist saying, Mohamedou is hearing voices now. Is that normal? And the army psychologist writing back and saying, well, given the level of, sensory deprivation, hallucinations are to be expected.
I was just thinking as you're speaking, this is all happening to a man who has never been charged, and a federal judge actually ordered his release from Guantanamo, but he still remains trapped in this hellhole. This is very incredible predicament here.
Well, it is, and it's a shameful predicament. And in one sense, this manuscript, which he wrote in 2005, is just a very simple call for justice. And that call for justice was suppressed for 7 years, as part of a larger regime of secrecy that's been imposed on him and, and on all the men who have been held in Guantanamo. That secrecy was purposeful, from the start. It existed specifically in order to allow torture and other human rights abuses to happen. Then, it was prolonged in order to hide the fact that abuse had happened and ultimately to, forestall accountability for those abuses. And, to think that the failure to deliver justice, to deliver, a decision on, or even deliver, make a case for why they are holding this man, for all of these years, the fact that some of that failure may actually have been just part of a effort to conceal what was done to him, to hide the crimes that were committed, to him, to his person, that should disturb every American. And, this is now almost 10 years after he wrote the manuscript. And, the questions of why Mohamedou is in Guantanamo should have been answered long ago. And, the American people should ask the government to answer those questions. They've been answered, as you say, in a habeas corpus proceedings, which resulted in a judge concluding that the government has no case against him. He's never been charged, and so he should be released.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one last question. You got a manuscript that was when people read this, and hopefully a lot of people are going to read this, when you got that, you got a manuscript, and when you talk about redacted, I want people to understand that there were, on every page almost, there's these thick black lines blocking out text. And in some cases, there's like five pages all at once that are all just blacked out. And so it's like even the simplest, male or female pronoun is blocked out. Then it was just looking at that, I kept wondering, how the hell did Larry work with this to actually, make this and to basically retain the basic human and the beauty and the power of the book when you're faced with doing it with things that have whole, it's really disturbing when you read this, where you just see blocks of text blocked out.
Well, I mean, you're right. And these are the fingerprints of the censorship regime that continues to exist in this place. To this day, no writer or journalist has ever spoken or communicated directly with a Guantanamo prisoner. And that's obviously, a large part of that is to keep the prisoners from telling their stories, to from becoming human, you know, human faces and human, you know, human biographies for the American people. So, you know, the what's amazing is, you know, how much we get in this book. So, yes, the redactions were stumbling blocks and obstacles in a lot of places, but, you know, what you get is his, this voice, this, you know, this approach, this experience, this way of interpreting and presenting experience, this, you know, this real writer's sense of form and beauty and character and all of these things. I mean, they are vivid even with the redaction. So for me, the process was just following that voice, listening to that voice, following the clues, learning that that voice was always trustworthy, you know, and even, you know, even for me, throughout the year, I came to appreciate ever more at every turn how, you know, how just, you know, accurate and truthful and, you know, and fully realized his narrative was. So, you know, that I sort of followed his lead on it. And then I had alongside of it, you know, like I said, this whole, you know, dozens, if not, you know, hundreds of pages of government documents that align exactly with his story. So, you know, some of those redactions, you get a sense of what's behind those redactions because that same information exists in other documents. He tells, you know, the story that he tells in this book, he also tells in some form, you know, much shorter, but to these two review boards in Guantanamo in 2004 and 2005. Interestingly, in 2005, when he's beginning, this is the first time that he's recounted his abuse. In 2004, which was just after the abuse had ended, he was clearly terrified to talk about it. So they're asking him if he's been abused. He said, you know, I really don't want to talk about that. 2005, he starts to tell the story to the review board. And just as he's getting to the part where he's sexually assaulted by these two female interrogators, and then describes, you know, leading up to this kidnapping that we talked about, the transcript, you know, in boldface type says, at this point, the recording equipment malfunctioned. Mm. And they offer a kind of cursory summary of what must have been many, many minutes of him telling this, you know, this terrible, harrowing story. So, you know, this is a story that has been, you know, suppressed and suppressed and suppressed again. But for me, like I say, when I got this manuscript in 2012, much of that story had already been public knowledge, you know, because of the declassification of the documents. And, you know, but what we had never had was a voice like this that could help us understand so clearly what this means. And, you know, that voice triumphs even over the redactions in the manuscript itself.
I agree 100%. Larry, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Larry Seams. Larry is the editor of a brand new book, a very powerful book and a very unique book. It's the first book to be put out by a current Guantanamo prisoner, by a man who's still trapped on the Guantanamo torture chamber. And that book is Guantanamo Diary by Mohamedou Ould Slahi.
We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a message from Carl Dix about April 14th and the day of no business as usual to stop police murder. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Police on My Back from The Clash. On February 7th and 8th, there was a very important two-day conference in Atlanta. And it was a conference that was attended by 170 people from different walks of life. They were of different nationalities and different ages, and they came from cities all over the country. And at the end of that conference, they issued a call from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network for a day of massive resistance this April 14th as a crucial step to get back on the offensive in the fight to stop police murder. And right now, we're going to hear a pre-recorded message from Carl Dix of Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party talking about the April 14th day of No Business as Usual to Stop Police Murder.
Okay, I'm Carl Dix. I'm down with the Revolutionary Communist Party, and I'm a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and I have an important message about April the 14th. April 14th needs to be a day when business as usual in this country gets disrupted, when everybody who hates the way the police murder people and get a pass from this system when they do it know that that is the day to act to stop this. There was a meeting of 170 people in Atlanta called by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we decided that this was the day to do it, April the 14th, and everybody who was at that meeting and everybody who wasn't at that meeting but knows police murder needs to stop has got to get on a mission to make April the 14th as powerful as it can be. We have to do this. We've reached a crossroads in the battle to stop police murder. When people stood up in Ferguson following the murder of Michael Brown, when the defiant young people went into the streets and stayed in the streets in the face of everything that the system threw at them, tear gas, rubber bullets, and more, that reached out to people all across the country. It let people who were suffering the same kind of problems know that we could stand up and do something about it. It opened the eyes of those who didn't suffer it to see these horrors going down and called on them to join into the resistance. And that went to an even higher level when the system let the cops who murdered Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York walk. People were in the streets all across the country. It was beautiful, it was powerful, and it was very necessary. People were calling out the way this system abuses and mistreats black people and Latino people in ways that hadn't happened in decades. And it was challenging people to look at what happened and to take a stand on it. The ugly reality of how this system brutalizes and has its cops even murder black people that had been covered up for so long was being ripped apart and put right out in the open. That was important, that was necessary. Now look, the folks who run this system, they didn't like it. And in fact, they've been trying as hard as they can to stuff everything back, to push the resistance down. They've come out with mass arrests, heavy charges, outrageous bail. And they've also tried to confuse and disorient people, trying to flip the script and say it's the police who are heroes doing a tough job, and that the people who are protesting what the police are doing, well, they're the ones that's wrong. That's bull. The people who are right are the people who stood up and said police murder has to stop. We're the ones who got right on our side, not the brutal murdering cops and not the system that has them out there doing that stuff. We cannot let them push us back, sisters and brothers, because they want to continue the normal routine of America, a normal routine that has wanton police murder built into its very fabric and framework as a concentration point of a whole program of abuse targeting black and Latino people and other oppressed people. This has got to stop, and not only do we need to continue resisting, we got to retake the offensive. We got to go from thousands to bringing more people out and up ultimately to the point of a movement of millions of people acting to stop this. And April 14th has got to be a very important part of doing that. It's got to be a day when we retake the offensive, when we build on, continue, but go much higher with this. Students, thousands and thousands of students, campuses all across the country, have got to act on that day. In the communities, people have got to gather, stand together, stand up, raise their voices, and act to stop business as usual. Everybody needs to be a part of this. Everybody who sees the horror police murder and knows that it's got to stop. And we can't wait till April 14th. We got to get on a mission right now to make this happen. A call was issued by that meeting in Atlanta for April the 14th as a day of disrupting business as usual. That call's got to be spread everywhere. Everybody's got to get a copy of it. Everybody's got to see it online and in different ways. A hashtag shutdown A14 has got to be spread everywhere. Spread it online. Put it on stickers. Get it out there. Get everybody involved in it. Get everybody involved in building up to this and making plans to act building up to April 14th and to act on April 14th. Look, this system has no answer for the way that police wantonly brutalize and murder people. In fact, it has the police out there doing that because the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people, but to protect and serve the system that rules over the people. This is illegitimate. It's no damn good. It's got to be stopped, and it's up to us to stop it, and April 14th is an important day to build up to it. April 14th, disrupt business as usual. Go to the website, stopmassincarceration.net. Get material there, spread it. Also go to the website, revcom.us. Find reports on that meeting, materials to spread, and get it everywhere. Police murder must stop, and it's up to us to stop it. April 14th. Shut down. Be a part of it. Make it happen.
That was Carl Dix, and it was a message he released in the aftermath of the April 14th conference down in Atlanta, Georgia. And the conference issued a call for no business as usual on April 14th to stop police murder. To find out more information about this, you can go to revcom.us, or you can go to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network website, which is stopmassincarceration.net. All right, that just about wraps up our show for the day. I want to thank all of my guests today, Andy Worthington, Larry Seams, and Carl Dix. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Federico Garcia. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with just a little bit more from The Clash and Police on My Back. Talk to you again next week.